many of the men with whom he associates end up being not only critics, but men who actually lead coups against the Athenian democracy. And above all, Socrates' greatest student is Alcibiades, who's he's certainly no oligarch or no conservative, but he's a demagogue. He would be a tyrant if he could be. And every time I study Socrates and Alcibiades, I get very nervous because Socrates is held to account based on the actions of his student, Alcibiades. And I often wonder about that frequently in my years of teaching at Tulane, what might happen to me. In any case, the unforeseen consequence is that at the time of the Peloponnesian War, there are more than just conservative critics, conservative opponents. Men such as Thucydides, son of Milesius, who was a critic of Pericles' policy vis-a-vis the allies and the building programs, but men who don't even get involved in political life, but are more frequently found in the law courts and more than willing to collaborate with the Spartans in betraying the city and bringing Athens back to the type of aristocratic government, the patrias politeia, the ancestral constitution, which in their mind is undemocratic. And that was an important development in the generation and a half before the Peloponnesian War. The reforms were clearly controversial in Pericles' own day. From 461 to 457 BC, when the major reforms of that created the so-called radical democracy, when those reforms were passed, Athens hovered at the brink of civil war. There was a coup attempted in 457 BC. Cimon actually broke it up. There were threats of violence. Ephialtes, who was apparently seen as the brains of the team, probably mistakenly, Ephialtes and Pericles together had agitated for democratic reform for some years. He was assassinated either in 462, 461 BC. Some sense of what happened in Athens that allowed those reforms to be passed may be obtained in looking at the great trilogy of Aeschylus, the greatest of the tragedians, in my opinion, who wrote his final great work that comes down to us. It's produced in 458 BC, the Oresteia. It is the only trilogy that comes down to us from the entire of antiquity. Many of the tragedies were presented as trilogies, and we have it because that trilogy was seen as the finest of all available to the Byzantine scholars who set up the literary traditions that would be studied in the Middle Ages. This actually goes back to the school of Alexandria in the 3rd century BC. And many of the works we have from antiquity are literally dictated by what the curriculum was in the Library of Alexandria and the teaching institutions in Ptolemaic Egypt that were then passed to the Byzantine Christians and came down to us. And so the fact that we have 7 plays of Aeschylus, 7 of Sophocles, supposedly 21 of Euripides as an extra manuscript, but the 777, that was all devised back in the Alexandrian curriculum. Aeschylus wrote about 120 tragedies, as far as we can tell. In any event, this tragedy, which is set in the city of Argos, substituting for the ancient city of Mycenae, is a retelling of the tale of Agamemnon and Clytemnestra. For those who recall your Iliad and your Greek legend, Agamemnon, the lord of Mycenae, and it's sort of updated for the Athenian audience, Argos, goes off to the Trojan War, fights to get Helen back for his brother Menelaus, and while he's away, his wife Clytemnestra conspires with a cousin, Agamemnon's cousin, Agestis, to take the throne, and she is angry because their daughter Iphigenia had been sacrificed for favorable winds to go to Troy. The play opens, the first play, the Agamemnon, opens with a spectacular speech by a watchman. And it probably was performed at the dawn in the Theater of Dionysus on the southern slopes of the Acropolis, where the watchman is waiting for the fires to show the fall of Troy. And he bursts into this beautiful paean in which he describes the stars rolling away in the early dawn. And Aeschylus is exploiting the landscape and the time and the drama started, and all of a sudden he realizes, oh my gosh, there are the lights. Agamemnon's on the way. The war has been won. And what happens is that the chorus of men, which represents sort of the boule of the city, comes in, and Clytemnestra lays out her plan to do in her husband. And Agamemnon is lured into his bath and unceremoniously slain. Clytemnestra and Aegisthus come out and essentially become tyrants of the city. They have avenged a blood feud.